In today's podcast, I recall how Great Britain coped without the rest of Europe when our backs really were against the wall. I've called it, "There's no waste where there's pigs." That was one of my mother's much-used expressions. With my interest and hope of Great Britain leaving the European Union, I've been chatting to friends and relations, not, I would add, trying to influence them in any way. Now that statement will cause some disbelief among friends on the social media, but it's true. I have no idea how my family are going to vote in the forthcoming referendum. I'm the first to admit that I'm quite a political animal with leanings to the right of Margaret Thatcher and next to Attila the Hun, and on top of that I've never agreed with anything the European Union stands for. As a writer I use the social media as a tool to express my views, which I'm happy to do, and I'm the first to admit they're strong views. At home, however, although I make no secret of either my politics or my religion, I also believe they are personal, and I've never attempted to evangelise either. This could hark back to my time at sea when both subjects were taboo. In a confined space of a shipmate was just that, and everyone's personal space was sacrosanct. I can still hear the voice of a much-travelled master at arms saying, "If you can't stand the smell of your shipmate's breath, you shouldn't have joined." Hence, no preaching or tub-thumping at home. Not sure what that digression was about. As I was saying, chatting to my daughter and grandson in particular about memories of when Great Britain, I like that much better than UK, coped in World War II, when we really were on our own. Being of my great age and probably sounding like Del Boy's Uncle Albert during the war, I began chatting on how we, and in particular my mother, coped with the shortages of everything, and food in particular. Ma was a fearsome, strong-minded, independent woman and the daughter of a coal miner, brought up in Edwardian times in a Durham pit village. My pa was a career airman in the RAF, having joined the Royal Flying Corps as a boy cook and a warrant officer when World War II broke out. We had left a life in married quarters and settled in a delightful home counties village called Woburn Sands, which is on the borders of Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire. As a service wife, Ma was quite used to her husband being away for long periods, so she didn't suffer with the sudden trauma of being abandoned when their spouses were called up to serve king and country and having to cope alone with their children and keep house and home together. It may have been less traumatic for Ma, but having to feed and clothe my older sister and me when everything that could be was rationed, and if it wasn't, it was either unobtainable or in short supply, and that was difficult. And then, just to stop us from getting too soft in our idyllic surroundings, the government decided to pressurise us into taking in a Jewish family from the bombing in London, consisting of a mother and her two daughters. Their home had been reduced to rubble while they were in the shelter of an underground station. Thank goodness they were an absolutely lovely family, but I'm sure you can imagine the total upheaval it brought to our existence. When I hear of the likes of Bob Geldof and the Bleeding Heart Brigade of politicians and actors pontificating about welcoming Muslim refugees into their home, I cannot wait for a single one of them to fulfil their promises. Their libtard promise much and perform little fantasy world. Anyway, I digress again. I do that sometimes. I look back on that time and how my mother decided that no matter how Adolf Hitler, aided and abetted by our own politicians and their red tape, interfered, we would survive. And my goodness, we survived. I can only speak for my mother, and she is long dead, and anyway the statute of limitations must have long expired for mother and all her friends who saw it as their duty to get round the restrictions placed on their welfare. We had a large garden, so mother became a bricklayer. don't ask where the bricks appeared from, but Marston Valley Brick Company made them some 7 miles away. She built a fine pigsty, and 2 female piglets appeared to become our breeding sows as a way of to supplement our meat ration. Our evacuee's mother turned to and built a chicken run, and 6 pullets and a cockerel appeared. Egg production was the plan, mainly to feed us, as eggs were a rationed commodity. Again, mother had a cunning plan. We were able to exchange one's egg ration for an allowance of chicken feed. Chickens were killed for food as soon as they stopped laying eggs, and I soon became quite adept at wringing their necks and plucking out feathers. Some were in mother's plan, and the reason we added a cockerel to our menagerie right from the start was that she intended to breed her own replacement flock of chickens, hence the need for a cockerel to fertilise the eggs, and thus all of our eggs were fertile. She had read a book somewhere about a family who made their own incubator. I think it was a novel rather than a DIY book, but anyway, we subsequently had a tea chest cut down and fitted with a couple of electric light bulbs, and we eventually supplied ourselves and friends and neighbours with a constant supply of little yellow day-old chicks. I suppose it was after the war that I discovered that the maker of rules and regulations specifically to put a spoke in mother's plans wasn't called the bloody Ministry of Food. Anyway, we had started with 2 prospective breeding sows, and mother could only have a license to keep 1. So a second pigsty was built on our allotment plot, and whenever an inspector called or someone from the local pig club paid a visit, their inspections were rotated between the one in the backyard and the other in the allotment. The licensing was all to do with the supplies of pig food and how much meat ration had been surrendered. For centuries, gardeners and smallholders had kept poultry and the odd pig or two for their own house use. The powers that be recognised that come what may, such practice would continue, so they encouraged groups of people to form pig clubs that were allowed legally to buy and feed and look after pigs. Pigs were normally fed on scraps from homes, cafes, bakeries, and anything edible that came to hand. Clubs were allowed to purchase legally small amounts of corn or feed to supplement this meagre diet. You will not believe the number of sacks of meal that fell off the wagon. Of course, this was years before the combine harvesters became common use, and the corn was cut very inefficiently with rotary cutters and stacked in sheaves to dry out before carting them to the threshing drum. Literally hundredweights of ripe corn seeds spilled and were left on the fields to waste, much to the delight of the local wild bird population and the local livestock owners, who were given permission to glean. It would have been wasted anyway. My fearsome mother recruited a gang of holidaying schoolchildren as gleaners, and in about 2 weeks at the end of harvest, our 2 barns and the allotment shed were filled with sacks of free grain. Pigs and piglets are greedy animals, and feeding has to be constant and never stops. Bins were placed at certain spots around the village for the reception of kitchen waste, which was collected by the council's lorry driver. The stuff was sorted and sold to poultry and pig keepers. We sometimes beat the council lorry and sorted out the good stuff, if you like, cutting out the middleman. We acquired a 2-wheeled barrow, and as we were surrounded by the Duke of Bedford's forests and had carte blanche permission to collect firewood, most of our fuel was logs, long before wood-burning stoves became fashionable. I can remember on a couple of occasions collecting literally hundredweights of acorns and sometimes sweet chestnuts in that barrow just to feed the pigs on. They loved them, shells and all. So we not only had well-fed pigs, we had happy pigs. As the war progressed, we used to get pig's wool delivered that was collected from sorters in London. This food waste was called Tottenham pudding, which we assumed was its source, although something at the back of my mind has me remembering that it was sourced in Edmonton, wherever that is. No matter it was dreadfully smelly stuff, the pigs loved it. Our pigs, both the legal ones and the supplementary ones, thrived on the diet provided by mother. Each sow produced around 10 piglets, which were fattened for slaughter in around 12 to 16 weeks. There was a big day when Ma's legal pigs were slaughtered through the pig club. Half the carcasses were sold for a pittance, as Ma said, to the government to help with rationing, and the remainder was divided between club members as either pork or bacon. When another member slaughtered their animal, we were given a share of theirs. Perhaps a month later, perhaps 10 or so of our illegal porkers that had also been fattened for slaughter, this time was a real red-letter day, when a certain butcher, with the help of the long-retired slaughterman and perhaps a couple of Italian prisoners of war, collected our harvest in a large lorry. I have no real recollection of the black market distribution, but on these occasions we had whole smoked hams hanging in our barn, legs of pork, sides of bacon, shoulders of pork, pork tenderloin, rib chops, loin chops, and of course sausages and black pudding. We had no refrigerators in those days, but our tame butcher and backup from our tame fishmonger did, and they were very well rewarded to house our household meat supply. Not just friends and neighbours received benefits from mother's allotment. The butcher and fishmonger could only look after so much of our prime cuts, and anything that we couldn't smoke in the form of ham or bacon was distributed on that day. I can remember our local Bobby always had a roasting leg joint together with some kidneys and liver. Possibly to salve mother's conscience, our vicar, the Roman Catholic priest, and the Methodist minister were all beneficiaries, and no one knew of the other recipient, but that was the way of black market trade. It wasn't called that then, it was called being neighbourly. Well, that's the tale of our pigs and poultry. As the war progressed, mother acquired two nanny goats and a billy goat, but that's another story, and I'm going to keep it in my locker for another day. I think the funniest memory was of our vacuees. They were Orthodox Jews. I used to get pocket money for chopping sticks and lighting their fire on Shabbat, which is observed from sundown on Friday until sundown on Saturday. Oy vey. But needs must when the devil drives, and Mama Levitt decided that rules could be bent for the duration. They enjoyed pork every bit as much as we did. She told a white lie to her girls, namely that it was chicken, in case they let it slip to their father when he visited. But they discovered a real fondness for lovely roast crackling. In this digital age, I'm sure that my mother would have been a leading campaigner against rationing and the Ministry of Food in particular. There is no doubt that it was for propaganda purposes, making certain that the British public felt that they were doing their bit every much as the boys on the front. The Ministry of Food employed thousands of civilians, jobs worth every one. As it was sheer luck that Mother wasn't arrested for doing her bit for the war effort. Every single part of the pig can be eaten except for the squeal, and as Mother often said, there's no waste where there's pigs. These days, I would add, it also keeps Muslims away. Thanks for listening.